Welcome to the Fitzgerald Theater on Exchange Street in downtown St. Paul for tonight's debate, which is co-sponsored by the St. Paul Pioneer Press. I'm Will Hadlin, Senior Vice President for Public Affairs for Minnesota Public Radio. In less than 48 hours, the people of Minnesota will select a candidate for the Democratic Farmer Labor Party to run for the United States Senate. What better place to hold this final debate of the primary election than in the capital city of Minnesota, a mere five blocks from our state capitol building, in a theater located on a street named Exchange? What better format for a debate than a live audience, the largest live audience of any of the debates held thus far? In addition to the hundreds of people attending tonight's debate, NPR is broadcasting the debate to 98% of the eligible voters of the state on our news and information stations. The debate can also be heard and seen worldwide on the web at minnesotapublicradio.org. Tonight's debate returns us to the roots of our democracy, when candidates for office debated not only their opponents, but personally stood before the voters to tell them why they should be selected for a job in what many call the world's greatest debating society, the United States Senate. In this day of negative attack ads, soft money contributions, and 15-second sound bites, what better tradition to establish and maintain than the tradition of a final debate in the state's capital city? Let the voters hear, unfiltered by any media, the candidate's position. Let the voters hear without commercial interruption why each candidate believes they can best represent the interests of the average person of the state. On behalf of Minnesota Public Radio and the St. Paul Pioneer Press, I want to thank our audience for attending this event. I also want to thank the four major candidates for honoring their commitment to attend and participate in tonight's debate. It is my honor to introduce the moderator of this final DFL Senate debate, the host of NPR's midday program, Gary Eichten.
Good evening. Well, candidates have been busy this weekend, very, very busy, traveling throughout the state, and I sure want to add my thanks to Will's comments, thanking them for including us on their schedule this weekend. 2 years ago, you might recall, we held the final pre-primary debate before the gubernatorial election. This year we have the Senate candidates. With some luck, we'll be able to put together something right before the November general election this year. And our goal here is to turn these debates at the Fitzgerald Theater into a real biennial tradition, something that the voters of Minnesota and the candidates running in the state of Minnesota can count on as a great forum, a last chance to discuss the issues. Stakes on Tuesday really couldn't be a whole lot higher. Whoever wins the DFL primary on Tuesday will move on to the November general election against incumbent Republican Rod Grams, and polls indicate that the DFLer who wins could have a good chance to unseat Senator Grams. As for the... Perhaps one of our few notes of unanimity tonight. Unfortunately for the other candidates, the ones who don't win on Tuesday, that's pretty much the end of the road. Despite months and months of hard work, despite spending all that time and money, they're going to be out of the race. Hope for richer, we hope for the experience, but kaput nonetheless. And so before we begin, I really would like to urge you to give all of them a nice round of applause for making the effort, and not just these candidates, but all the candidates in all the races for all the parties. Okay, a couple of notes about our format. The debate is 2 hours long. We're going to take a break at 8 o'clock, so you get a chance to stretch your legs a little bit. Most of the time is going to be devoted to your questions. Our trusty Oprahs are stationed around the theater, so we can get a microphone to you, just get their attention, and and you can hook up together. Those of you watching and listening to us on our website, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, you can send us your questions and we'll include as many as possible through the evening. We try to avoid pomp and circumstance as much as possible, so do feel free to cheer your candidate on, but be polite, let the candidates have their say. So, let's officially meet the candidates here, the DFL candidates for the U.S. Senate. We'll do this in alphabetical order, if that's okay. If you would please take a minute or two to explain to the audience why you think you're the best DFL candidate in the field, why you should be nominated on Tuesday rather than the other three candidates. To begin, Minneapolis trial attorney Michael Cerisi.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you to NPR, and welcome everyone and obviously the other candidates. Self-interest versus the common good. Two principles embodied in our Constitution. Two principles that we as a people and as a nation have struggled with since the beginning of this republic. I am running because I believe to the fiber of my being that over the last 15 years we have tilted towards self-interest. We need to re-examine and reawaken the common good. When we look at the non-Social Security surplus of over $2 trillion, we must ask ourselves, what should we do with that? I say we should do what we have always done best in this country, invest in the common good, because there are some things we do get better together than we do individually. And once we secure Social Security and Medicare, once that's taken care of, we should direct that surplus to reducing the debt, to rural revitalization, to health care, to affordable housing. These are the issues that are affecting each and every one of the Minnesotans, and I see it in their eyes, and I feel it in the words they speak, which come from their heart. And why me? Because as the Minneapolis Tribune said, I would be the most powerful advocate for the common good. For my entire career, I have taken on special interests. Indeed, I am the only one up here tonight who has taken them on consistently over 29 years and changed their course of conduct for the common good. That is what we need in Washington. People are looking for leadership. I believe I can afford that leadership to the people of this state and to this nation. Thank you, Gary.
That was Michael Cerisi. Next up is former state auditor Mark Dayton. Mr. Dayton?
I want to also thank NPR and the Pioneer Press. And what distinguishes me from my three very impressive DFL competitors is between 15 and 30 years of public service. I've devoted my entire career to helping other people and fighting for the causes that I believe in. From 1969 to 75, I stood up against the Vietnam War, for which I earned the distinction of being named the only Minnesotan on Richard Nixon's enemies list, which I've always said if I die tomorrow is what I'd like to have on my tombstone, and if I lose on Tuesday will probably be the only thing that could go on my tombstone. 1981, I started the Minnesota campaign to save Social Security, which became the model for the successful national organization chaired by Congressman Claude Pepper, who so credited me here in Minnesota in June of 1982. In 1991, as state auditor, I unsuccessfully opposed the state bailout of Northwest Airlines as unnecessary and unfair to Minnesota taxpayers, and I successfully led the fight to stop Northwest from getting an additional $250 to $500 million from the state public pension funds. All of 1995, after Newt Gingrich, Bob Dole, and their right-wing Republican allies had taken over the U.S. Congress and made my longtime friend Paul Wellstone their number one target for defeat in 1996, I co-chaired his re-election committee and chaired his finance committee and helped him win his fight against those powerful special interests. I'm the only candidate here tonight to serve in statewide public office, and I've served in over three decades. I've also served on the boards of over 50 organizations throughout the state, and I've been involved with hundreds more. At the Last Supper, the Lord said, "Let whoever would be the leader among you first become the one who serves." I've done so, and with your support, I will continue to do so for $1 a year.
Okay, that was Mark Dayton. And up next, the party's endorsed candidate, State Senator Jerry Janicich.
Why am I the best Democrat? Pretty good question. About 10 months ago, I took that to the Democrats of the state, average people, all walks of life, who went through a process called the DFL endorsement, who didn't have money to give, but for the most part gave time. And I spent that time talking to each and every one of them, telling them why I was the best Democrat. And the first week of June, the best Democrats in the state got together and they endorsed somebody. They endorsed what they thought was the best Democrat for the United States Senate. That candidate was me. In the early 90s, when I was in the state Senate, I authored a bill for breakfast for our kids. It was a pilot. It ended up to be a pilot project. Today, every public school has the program. In the early 90s, I co-authored with Alan Speer, human rights bill for Minnesota. It became law. In the middle 90s, I was part of three, Senator Pat Piper from Austin, Senator Jane Ranum from Minneapolis, who created the Department of Children's Families and Learning and led the argument on early childhood, which ultimately gave us a division for early childhood. A couple years ago, I was entrusted with the largest housing bill in our state's history. Why am I the best Democrat? Because for the last 18 years in public service, I've been doing what we've been talking about in this campaign. I've been putting people in a room and bringing them to consensus, and I've been passing legislation, which is what all of us have had some good part of. The United States Senate is about doing that. It's about bringing what you believe to the table and making it part of people's public lives. Why am I the best candidate? Because since I was 10 years old, my grandmother and I had this discussion about public service and what it meant. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to be here even, because truly, truly, the Democrats of this state have given me one heck of an opportunity.
All right, that was Jerry Janicich. And finally, our fourth candidate this evening, Minneapolis Business Executive Rebecca Yanish.
Thank you, Gary. I'm delighted to be here tonight. I think it's very fitting that we have this discussion in a historic theater. I've got a special warm place in my heart for historic theaters, have actively worked to restore them myself. And the work I've done with historic theaters has actually been work for over 20 years in helping restore community also, all throughout the state of Minnesota. I come to this race with many life experiences that have been shared by many Minnesotans. When I talk about health care issues, I remember what it feels like to be without health care. And that's why when I talk to senior citizens about their struggles right now with prescription medications, I can feel that pain. When I talk to young people about education, I remember what it felt like to be 21 years old, single mom, realizing I needed that extra education to be able to support my daughter and myself. And I realized the struggle of young people trying to attain that college degree. When we talk about affordable housing, it's from the perspective of having worked in the city of Minneapolis to develop or retain 4,000 units of affordable housing and watched as the federal government moved further and further away from providing solutions on that drastic issue. And when we talk about farm issues, I know what it feels like to be a fifth generation farmer's daughter and watch the loss of farm income across our state. And especially also when I think of the issues of gun violence and the need for greater safety in our schools and homes for our children, I remember the pain of losing a family member to gun violence. Now, any of us tonight sitting in front of you would be a better vote than Rod Graham's. But I'm here tonight in front of you not only as a vote, but a voice. And it's a voice of shared experiences with many Minnesotans, but not a voice found currently in the United States Senate. Thank you very much.
And that was Rebecca Yanish. Okay. Polls indicate that there are still a fair number of people who do plan to vote in the DFL primary on Tuesday who don't know who they're going to vote for. You often hear some of those people anyway say, well, they all basically take the same position on all the issues. I don't know who to choose. So to help those undecided voters, let's focus here on some areas where you folks don't agree, if there are any. Not trying to stir up trouble here, but just to clarify things for those undecided voters. What I'm going to do is just go around and you can each outline where you might differ with the other candidates, and then we can discuss it a little bit if there's something to discuss, or we'll move on to some other questions. Mark Gayton, let me start with you. Can you tell me one issue where you disagree with Jerry Janicich?
Jerry, in the Minnesota legislature last spring, voted to pass legislation which weakened Minnesota's protections against these large feedlot operations. In fact, the federal EPA wrote the state MPCA and said that if this law passed, Minnesota would be below the federal minimum standards for water quality safety. And if I'm elected to senator, I'm going to go out and make sure that EPA enforces that letter and gets Minnesota back up to where it should be at the top, certainly not below the minimum of those water quality standards.
Can you tell me one area where you disagree with Rebecca Yanish?
Rebecca and I disagree about the scope of health care. I believe that health care should be universal, that we should advance a program to provide for complete national health care for all of our citizens. I propose employer mandates to accomplish that. And Rebecca takes a more incremental approach.
Mike Cerisi, any one area where you disagree with Mike Cerisi?
I would say the same on health care, and also Mike and I disagree on the effect of this administration's trade policies. I believe that NAFTA would need to be fundamentally revised so that Minnesota farmers, especially in northwestern Minnesota, are not disadvantaged by the dumping of wheat, and Minnesota workers, northeastern Minnesota, Winona, are not thrown out of work due to unfair foreign competition.
Jerry Janicich, any one area where you disagree with Rebecca Yanish?
Never thought we were going to have this much fun. Well, I guess probably the one area where we might differ a little bit is the housing piece. I believe the bill we passed in the Senate that I spearheaded was all about low and moderate middle incomes having access to affordable housing. And I think in Minneapolis maybe we did some things that were more upscale, more income driven, and to the higher incomes. Okay, I'd say that's probably one of the things.
Any area disagree with Michael Cerisi?
Well, I think I could figure out one or two. I guess
this is going to be good.
I guess with Michael, I probably maybe the world trade stuff. He probably is out there a little too far for me. I went to Seattle and I marched because I actually, the truth of the matter is that what happens in other parts of the world in a global economy definitely will have effect on every young person here. And we're going to do, and we will trade with almost everybody, and we currently are trading. In fact, our trade with China is records amount of money. The issue, I think, becomes whether they have carte blanche over everything. The trade is going to continue, but you would like to hold them accountable for human rights and labor standards and environmental standards. And I think we probably, just philosophically, there's probably a tweak there. And Mark, I do kind of worry about if I do lose, how many bottles of beer it's going to take at 2 1/4 to pay for a mandatory health care plan for my small business. And not that it's bad, because the truth of the matter is I'd love to be able to provide that. I'm just not sure how Tommy and I get there, okay, ultimately.
Rebecca Yanish, one area where you disagree with Michael Cerisi.
Well, I think that probably the biggest area of difference is Mr. Cerisi's reaction to the Freedom to Farm bill. He has indicated that he would not call for a repeal of that act. And from my view, again, from a personal view of the family that still actively farms, and also from a lot of testimony from farmers, I heard when I was traveling to Washington, D.C. in March for the Rally for Rural America, the consensus is really that the bill should be scrapped and we should start over. I think the evidence for scrapping the bill is also the high level of subsidies that have been required under the bill, where there is no targeting specifically for smaller farmers or for the priorities we have here in Minnesota.
Any area where you disagree with Mark Dayton?
Well, with Mark, it's fundamentally on the health care issues, but I would like to say that I do believe that health care is as fundamental a right to all Americans as education is. What I'm concerned about right now is, as a society, not everyone agrees that, and I'm concerned that we must take care of the 11 million uninsured children right now. Yeah. And our seniors who need access to prescription medication, and start that. I also, on the health issue, disagree with Mark on his support for medical savings accounts, because I think that really cheats just the healthy and the wealthy.
And Jerry Janisich, any points of disagreement?
Well, with Jerry, I mean, Jerry and I actually do share quite a bit, both coming from Greater Minnesota, but I disagree with his stance on the blood alcohol levels. I do think that it's very important that the tragedy of drunken driving and the toll on innocent lives is really unforgivable.
Mike Cerisi, any area where you disagree with Mark Dayton?
Yes, there is. I think Mark and I have profound differences on health care. Not that we shouldn't have universal health care in an incremental basis. I believe we should. But in how we get there, Mark would literally bankrupt small businesses, and Jerry is just an example of those who would be bankrupt by it. What we need to do is start focusing our attention as a nation on preventive health care. We do a great job. We do a great job in this nation on acute health care. It costs a lot of money, but we do a great job at it. We do a terrible job on preventive health care and on dealing with chronic diseases. So I would first look at the insurance industry. They should take all risks. They ought not be able to segment people out, only cherry-picking the people that did not have health problems. The insurance ought to be portable, and small businesses ought to be able to enter into buying pools. On the purchasing side, I would first of all extend the CHIPS programs, and Minnesota has been particularly disadvantaged by that, because we went into insuring children before the CHIPS program came on stream in 1997. But we should extend that, and you can do that and bring it in over a few years. Secondly, 55 and older, those people are the greatest segment, growing segment of uninsured. They ought to be able to buy into Medicare with a tax credit for it. Thirdly, with respect to small businesses, over half of the uninsured in this nation work for businesses who have 25 or fewer employees. We ought to get them in by giving them tax credits to get their employees involved. I disagree with Mark on the medical savings plans, because basically what he's going to do is, and Rebecca has touched on it, what you're going to have is the healthiest and wealthiest people going to MSAs, and you're going to be left with his universal health care, the diametrically opposed, by the way, Mark. You're going to be left with that where the poorest people are going to be there and the people that are unhealthy, and you're going to drive the cost to the nation as a whole right through the ceiling, and you're not going to be focusing on preventive health care.
Any area of disagreement with Jerry Janicich?
Well, I will, Jerry. Jerry and I actually get along quite well.
We use very well.
Well, we always do, Jerry. We always do, and we've had a lot of fun because Jerry, of course, has a bar, and my father, who started selling fruit and vegetables, went to a small grocery store, ended up with a small liquor store. So we come from a little bit of the same background. But where I disagree with him on, I think Jerry hit it, is on world trade. I think we've had, as a party, a misplaced emphasis on PNTR. And Jerry, you're right, there's a lot of trade with China, but, you know, it's a tremendous imbalance in it. They're selling us $85 billion worth of goods a year, and we're selling about $11 billion. But that's not why I want PNTR with China. Human rights organizations in China will tell you that once you embed a judicial process within a system, that will eventually extend to human rights, to labor laws, to environmental laws. And we cannot isolate ourselves from China in a geopolitical from a geopolitical standpoint. So I believe we have to be engaged with China, and we should go ahead with PNTR. But what I would do, and I think, Jerry, you and I agree on this, is I would kick down the doors of the WTO and democratize that process. If you want to change international trade, and we need international trade, we need an international trade organization, but we have to democratize it. We have to know what basis they're making their decisions. Who is doing the reports, what the minority reports are, how the decisions are being made, and the process has to be opened up, and stakeholders have to be there at the table. That's how I would do it, and I would focus our attention and all our attention on the WTO.
And any area of disagreement with Rebecca Yanish?
Well, Rebecca mentioned farms, and you're right, Rebecca, a lot of people don't like freedom to farm, but they like freedom to plant. Farmers like freedom to plant, and I've been all over this state, and I agree that you grew up on a farm and I did not. But I have spent about 60-70% of the time in this campaign since January traveling in greater Minnesota, and I've been listening. And people on the farms like the freedom to plant aspect of it. So that's why I said I wouldn't scrap it. It does need to be revised. We have had a history in this country of inexpensive food since the Second World War. The Western economies were ravaged during the Second World War. They saw their population starve. As a result, they look at food policy from a national defense standpoint, and they heavily subsidize it. When we went to Freedom to Farm, we put our farmers out at sea, and we said, hey, it's free trade. It's fair, but it isn't fair. It's not a level playing field. So we need to market intervene. We intervene in a lot of places, the Export-Import Bank, minimum wage, etc. We can go on and on and on. I believe we need to intervene. We need to go back to farmers' own reserve. We need CRP to be expanded. That's good for the farmers. It's good for the environment. It's good for sportsmen and sportswomen. And I would extend the loan repayment program, which is presently 9 months, creates a tremendously unequal playing field for farmers, and I'd extend that out to 2 to 3 years. Those are some of the things that we would do, but the devil is going to be in the details there, and that is, at what size do you cut off the support to the farmers? Because the old American way is, if you want to get real big, well, that's great, but at some point in time, if you're going to do that, you're going to do it on your own, and we shouldn't be subsidizing it. The problem today is that we're paying $25 billion a year on Freedom to Farm, and then we're coming in with another $8 billion after that, and 60% of which are going to farmers who don't need it, many of whom live on Wall Street and Fifth Avenue in New York City. So that's what our idea for it.
Now, before we move on to audience questions, do any of you want to say anything about what the other one said about you? Or should we move along?
Well,
Mark Dayton?
I was just saying, with regard to the medical savings accounts, that was a yes or no question asked in the Pioneer Press, which I objected to on a number of questions because it lends itself just to this kind of charge without having a chance to qualify it. You know, Kennedy Kassenbaum in 1997 provided for medical savings accounts on a limited basis as an option. I don't favor that as the solution, but in the present situation, I would be willing to support certainly Senator Kennedy and anybody else who has a reasonable proposal to permit people who are underinsured in the workplace and elsewhere to be able to put money away. It's a very imperfect solution, and as I've said before, I am the only one supporting employer mandates. I agree there should be purchasing pools for small businesses, as we did in Minnesota for workers' compensation. I believe that we should offer tax credits or partial government offsets for small businesses. But we have, as has been said, over half of the people who are uninsured who work for companies over the 25, one-third of whom work for companies with over 500 employees. And these are the Walmarts and the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and others who can, I believe, can darn well provide health insurance for their employees. And when they don't, the rest of us pay for it. And I'm the only one of these candidates who's taken that stand.
Rebecca Yanish.
Yeah, thank you. I want to respond to Jerry's comment, actually, on about affordable housing, and I do applaud Jerry's work in the state legislature. The state of Minnesota actually has stepped up more than any other state in the nation in terms of responsibilities on affordable housing, and again, that's why the contrast with the federal government moving further away is even more painful. But I do want to emphasize, when I talk about 4,000 units of affordable housing in Minneapolis, those were truly affordable housing units, and the moderate income or other housing that was developed in the city is outside of the 4,000 units there. Those units included Manitowoc Odena, American Indian housing for people with AIDS. It included the Glenwood, a facility for chronic inebriates. It included partnering with Hennepin County on very necessary housing for the homeless, the very lowest income population of anywhere in our state. So again, that's a record I'm very proud of.
Mike Cerisi.
I believe that in my opening remarks, Gary, I responded to all three who had an issue with me on one or the other, Freedom to Farm, PNTR, or healthcare. But I would like to respond to what Mark just said. And that is, Mark, now you say that you're not in favor of MSAs, and there was a yes or no answer. And I understand it was a yes or no answer to many of to all those questions in the St. Paul Pioneer Press. But workman's comp is totally different. I mean, you rate people there by the number of injuries and the type of industry you're in. If you adopted a workman's comp standard in medical insurance, those who are the poorest and in the lowest paying jobs would have the highest health care rates. You would again be segmenting the market rather than pooling the market together so that you can get people looking at preventive health care. It just doesn't match up. And the one thing you haven't answered with regard to your program is how much is it going to cost to have universal health care, and where's the money going to come from? You know, we're going to go on from this primary into the general election, and these questions are going to be asked. In fact, they're going to be asked starting Wednesday. How are you going to finance universal health care? Because people who are moderates and independents in this state want to know that question, and small businesses want to know that question. How are you going to finance that and still say that you're going to have MSAs, which are inherently inconsistent with what you're suggesting?
Jerry Janicich.
Yes, and I guess mine would be Mark and to the feedlots. Part of when you have these jobs and you're making decisions that affect people's lives, sometimes you have to do some balancing. I mean, it's no secret that the Sierra Club didn't endorse me, and part of it is because in the last 12 years in the House and in the Senate, I've had to balance jobs against some of the environmental things. And particularly, it gets tougher when you're starting to balance a rural economy against the environment. And we tried. There was a group of us that tried to change that bill to accommodate the environmental position. But we didn't get it done. We lost 34-33 in a vote. And our attempts that day kept getting lower and lower. And ultimately, I believe you can do more by being for stuff than being against it.
Oh, anybody else? Quickly. Mark Gaten,
well,
quick
I'll
time, and then we're going to
continue
move.
The discussion on the health care. My reference to workers' comp
goes back to early 1980s in Minnesota, when small businesses were having difficulty buying workers' comp insurance at the kind of rates that larger companies could buy. And the state of Minnesota set up a workers' compensation insurance corporation, which was operated without a single dollar of taxpayers' money, and has very successfully enabled small businesses and the self-employed to purchase insurance at those rates. One of the barriers for small businesses being able to provide coverage is the cost of these policies for very poor coverage terms. So one of my proposals has been and continues to be to have a purchasing pool similar, and it's an imperfect analogy, but it's the best one I have available, other than so that you could, small businesses could buy these policies at affordable rates. But Mike, you know, you keep attacking me. I expected to get attacked on Wednesday by the Republicans about my proposal for national health policy. I wasn't expecting to be attacked by Democrats throughout the last couple of weeks. And I would say again to you, what is the cost of not having national health coverage for all Americans? Who suffers? Who suffers, and what are we going to do about it? And I want to do something about it, and if my proposal isn't ideal, then propose something else. But don't tell me that you're only concerned about small businesses when large employers don't provide it either, and you don't want to do anything for those people as well.
Mark, may I respond?
Okay, very briefly.
Very
briefly, Mike Cerisi.
Briefly, I'm not attacking you, Mark. We're asking questions. We're probing. This is a debate. Okay? I look down at the press down here. It's sort of fun because when the press writes and whenever we question each other, so all of a sudden they say it's an attack. This is a debate, folks. I mean, we're probing. We're asking questions about what your positions are, and you still haven't answered the question, how much is yours going to cost? I mean, for you to suggest that I don't care about uninsured simply is not true, Mark. I have had to make sure that our employees have health insurance and pensions and good wages. I've had to do that in the marketplace.
Okay.
And it's not just a question of not caring about people. It's a question of how we're going to get there and make sure that we focus our medical care on preventive health care and that we can get people into the system economically. Because what you're proposing cannot be done overnight. And it's a false hope to hold out to say that you're going to do it.
All right, time to open it up for some audience questions. If you're just joining us on the radio, you're listening to a live debate from the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul, co-sponsored by Minnesota Public Radio and the St. Paul Pioneer Press, featuring the four major candidates for the DFL U.S. Senate nomination, the final debate now before Tuesday's primary election. Our candidates, Minneapolis trial attorney Michael Cerisi, state auditor Mark Dayton, state senator Jerry Janicich, and the Minneapolis business executive Rebecca Yanish. Those of you here at the Fitzgerald, raise your hand, get the attention of our Oprahs who are stationed around, and they'll get a microphone to you. Doug Tice, Steve Dornfeld from the Pioneer Press editorial staff, and NPR political reporters Laura McCollum and Michael Koo are handling Oprah duties this evening. Those of you online at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, send us your question. We'll add some of those to the mix as well. And if you're near a computer, do check out our website this evening. You can actually watch the debate besides listening to it. And there's also a wealth of information about the candidates on the website, even a fun feature where you can type in your position on the issues and find out which candidate comes closest to your views, kind of a computer dating type of situation. So MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Well, let's go to the audience here. Laura McCollum, got a question?
Thanks, Gary. I'm here with Bill Anderson of St. Paul, who has a question for Mark Dayton.
It's interesting that you and Mr. Cerisi are debating health care, considering that both of you have at one time or currently have prescription drug companies stocks in your personal portfolios. My question for you, Mr. Dayton, is that you talk about affordable health care for everyone, and you stated when this information came out that you weren't aware that there was still drug company stock in your portfolios, your personal investments. If your own fortune and your own money is that difficult to manage, how do you propose to manage the fortunes and the monies and the people in this
okay.
state? The people in this state who are currently without care, people in the small businesses, people like Jerry, people like Rebecca, and people like me.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Dayton.
The point of my mistake, which I've acknowledged repeatedly over the last few days regarding Abbott Laboratories, was not that I don't manage my own financial affairs, didn't see the name of the stock in my portfolio, which I actively manage when I run my own private investment company, and which I saw the value of. I inexplicably saw the name and did not associate it with being a pharmaceutical company. As I look back, I can't tell you how I didn't come to that realization, but that's the reason that I didn't sell it, as I sold the other pharmaceutical company stock, as I sold the oil company stocks before I ran. I can't imagine why I wouldn't have done so. The one thing I cannot think fairly be accused of by even people who disagree with me on everything else is I don't think anybody could fairly say I've ever tried to enrich myself at through my public service. I know that I'm incredibly lucky by the circumstance of my birth to have been born into wealth, and I have tried to use that in advocating consistently against causes and positions which ran against my own economic self-interest, and supporting candidates, political causes, and nonprofit organizations throughout this community that I believe in, and I will continue to do so whether I'm a U.S. senator or a private citizen.
Steve Dornfeld, you've got an audience member with a question.
Gary Rickelstein from Sunrise is wearing a bright gold Jerry Janusz t-shirt, has got a question about education.
Yeah, one of my greatest concerns is education, primarily early childhood through 12th grade. And my question for all the candidates is, what do you feel the role of the federal government is in education, particularly in K-12?
Mm-hmm. Can we just speak up, Gary?
Go ahead, Rebecca.
No? Okay. Thank you. And that's a question, too, that I've certainly been focusing a lot of time and attention on. And as I travel across the state, so many people come to me and say, I'm very concerned. I'm concerned about classroom sizes. I'm concerned about how we can recruit new teachers. How do we ensure that all our children have access to the best education possible in those early years? And the solutions I've been talking about is, first and foremost, let the federal government live up to its promises. When we talk about funding special education and promising to fund it at 40%, we should demand that promise is met rather than the 10% now. That's $300 million that would come to local school districts in the state of Minnesota. And I think that's a very important promise that should be kept. On the second issue, how do we get to smaller classroom sizes? How do we face the issue of a growing problem? In the next 10 years, half of our students, or excuse me, the next 10 years, half of our teachers will be retiring. And how do we ensure that we get good qualified teachers in there to continue working with our students? That's why I've proposed a program to provide loan forgiveness for college loans for young people wanting to get into the teaching profession. I think it's important to recruit them. Thank you. Yes. We all know there's a big disparity right now between starting teacher salaries and what the private sector can offer. So let's do that over a five-year program. Let's provide the student loan forgiveness, and let's make sure that we're mentoring those young teachers so we can strengthen our K-12 education. Thank you.
Mike Cerisi.
Well, since I got into this race back in October, I've talked about how we use the non-Social Security surplus, and education was one of the areas that I have always emphasized. It is the key to moving up the economic ladder, and I've been saying that since October. And with regard to education, I agree with some of the things I've been saying them since October that Rebecca just mentioned. We need to have to channel folks into socially desirable occupations. Nursing is another one, but education is one, and we do it with loan forgiveness programs. You know, we got a welfare system that's going to cut people off in 5 years, and that's coming up the year after this. Why wouldn't we have loan forgiveness programs for 5 years for the people who are going to teach our kids and allow them to move up the economic ladder? We need to make sure that we are educating new teachers and that they have the ongoing continuing skills. That's a role for the federal government. We need to make sure that our rural areas in this country have the facilities that they need. That's a role for the federal government. You know, Rod Grams on March 29th of this year voted against 100,000 new teachers. His position is that the federal government has no role in education. A position, by the way, that's directly contrary to what the Republican platform says. And now Mr. Graham's coming back in and saying, well, maybe there is some kind of role, although he does not define it. Education, education, education. It's the key. We have to make sure that we are helping our people get educated. Pell Grants is another area. We have increased the loans to kids. Pell Grants have gone down. Kids are graduating today with $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in debt. How can we expect them to go into professions that do not pay at those levels when they graduate with that type of debt? So the federal government, in my judgment, has a very profound role in education, because if we as a people and as a government do not educate our people, then what is the role of government?
Jerry Janicich.
The federal government, I believe, needs to step up when we talk about education. But not education as an education, but an education as in public education. We, for the most part, is this thing gone?
There you go.
Okay. All right, maybe I'm going in the wrong direction. We, for the most part, need to remember that if it wasn't for public education, there'd be very few of us who would have the opportunities we have today. And I'm going to tweak my friends up here just a little bit. I believe I'm the only one who sends their kids to a public school.
Not true, Jerry.
Isn't that? Oh, good.
No.
I guess it's not true.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I feel better.
Living proof, sitting right there in the audience.
All right.
Okay.
All right. I guess I'm only half right.
Yeah.
Sometimes
I had one. I had one too that went to public school.
Okay. But we lost a generation of kids because we weren't thinking in terms of how it should look, how our system should look. Education doesn't begin at kindergarten anymore. It doesn't begin at the 8th grade or 12th grade. Education today begins at birth. And in our society, we lost those kids because we didn't adjust to that. And part of what I was part of doing in the state Senate with Pat Piper and Jane Ranum was creating the Department of Children, Families, and Learning and the Early Childhood Division, because we needed to start focusing in our state and in this country on the early childhood issues. We leave our children at infant care and daycare while we're out working. We're number one with women in the workforce, and we're four or five on two people in the workforce in a family. We spent a ton of money in Minnesota building jails and prisons over the last 8 or 10 years. All that money, if invested on the bottom side of this, would not have been spent. It would have been spent for classroom size. It would have been spent for our buildings. It would have been spent for technology. And we need to make those investments and refocus just a little bit on where we're headed. The other piece that I think we need to do, and it's something that I introduced again this time, and I didn't quite get it done, and I'm hoping that there's somebody out there who will follow. Parental leave. Not parental leave as we know it, but parental leave that pays. Allowing this legislative session, I introduced the legislation and we got it to the conference committee that would allow a public-private partnership so that a parent after birth could spend time at home that they negotiated with their employer. Think about that. We'll pay infant care, we'll pay daycare, but we won't reward a parent. We didn't do that to my grandmother either, or for all practical purposes, my mother. And we need to think just a little bit out of the box and get there. And I think those are the kinds of things that I've been doing in the state Senate and in public service for the last 18 years. And that's why I still believe I'm the best Democrat.
Mark Dayton, would you care to comment?
My first job out of college was a public school teacher on the Lower East Side of New York City. And I've always said it was the toughest job I ever had. And anyone who devotes their life and career to public school education has my absolute respect and admiration. And having spent the last couple of years visiting over 100 schools throughout Minnesota, several hundred classrooms, I can say that the job that Minnesota teachers have today is more difficult and challenging than one I had 30 years ago in New York City because of so many different children from so many different backgrounds, countries, languages, and the like. And the big lie in Minnesota over the last decade is we're spending all this extra money on our public schools and we're not getting the desired results when, in fact, in real dollars, we're spending less per student than we did before, and relative to the needs of these kids, we are spending far less than we should, and we're making our public schools a scapegoat for the broader failures of society, and it ought to stop right now. In terms of the federal government role, which is far too small, it's only 7% of the support for K-12 education nationwide. I agree with what Rebecca and Mike and Jerry have said about increasing the federal share of special education to 40% of costs. Minnesota only gets 9% reimbursed today. It's one of the reasons that we're shortchanging all of our school children. That should be 40% immediately. That'd be $250 million extra per year for Minnesota. I support also, as others have proposed, loan forgiveness for teachers and for others at work kinds of community service work. I believe we should fully fund Head Start, so for every child to be eligible. As Jerry said, this is about priorities in this country. Expand the other early childhood programs, as have been outlined, and I believe we should also increase the child care tax credit for working families to at least 50% for each of their children in child care and for the care of dependent elderly family members in the home or elsewhere.
Okay, a quick comment, Jerry Janicich.
Well, I just, Mark, I did spend some time in a classroom. You ran that ad, and I know my wife didn't. You were the only one of us who spent time in a classroom. It was an ad. That's all right. Patty saw it. Okay, and she told me about it. But I just want, as Minnesotans, I want to make one.
I apologize to Patty if I misspoke.
Yeah, as Minnesotans, okay, the headline in the Minneapolis Star today had, I think it was today, had Ventura talking about state taking over 100% of public education funding. I think as Minnesotans, that's a heck of a discussion we should engage ourselves in. During this next legislative session, don't be afraid to be part of that discussion, because there is such an imbalance going on in our state today on how we're funding and how we're getting there. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of our schools that aren't doing the same things as other schools. So as Minnesotans, engage that issue.
Michael Cerisi, quick comment, and then we're going to move on.
One of the nice things about running for public office is the opportunity to meet with Minnesotans across the state. And I just want to say something following up on what Mark and Jerry and Rebecca have brought out here, and that is the job that our public educators are doing. Here in St. Paul, there's about 67 languages being spoken. In Minneapolis, over 80. I met a woman yesterday, a teacher, in Alexandria. She's not from Alexandria. They have a lake home up there. She was done with the first week of school, and she was almost at wit's end. She has six very difficult children in her class, special ed kids, and 20 mainstream kids. And she was explaining what she had to go through to try to educate the six, let alone the 20. And if you could have seen the stress in her and listened to the anxiety in her voice, and some of the press was with me, you would have been profoundly affected by what these teachers are facing on a daily basis. So our educators are doing a tremendous job. And rather than sitting out here and supporting vouchers, as the Republicans want to do, we ought to be enhancing the ability of our teachers and our schools to teach our children.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Janicich.
Mm-hmm. I just quickly, if I could, too, because I think there's an opportunity here. If you catch, Michael had talked about all the different languages that are in the Minneapolis and St. Paul in the communities.
In a global economy, we should, I mean, as a society in our state, make sure that our kids are picking up more than one. And there's nothing better than for them to learn it at the same time we're teaching English to other children. One of the most scariest things I've ever experienced in public office was going to Japan and sitting across a table with we were on one side of the table, and NKK, the fourth largest steel company in the world, was on the other side of the table. And they spoke English and Japanese, and I just spoke English. And I came home from that trip, and I started paying just a little bit more attention to what was going on around me. And it couldn't have been too much longer. We were coming out of a grocery store, my son Craig, Patty, and I. And as we're coming out of the grocery store, there were a group of kids having a discussion. And I turned to my son and I said, "So what did they say?" And he went, "I don't know." In a world economy, it's going to behoove all our children to know more than one or two languages.
Okay, we need to move along here. We have just about 2 minutes before we have to take a break for news. Michael Koo, you've got a question up there on the second floor.
That's right, Gary. I'm here with Bob Lamb from Minneapolis, who has a question for the candidates on foreign policy.
Yes, as you four candidates should know, thousands of children are dying every month in Iraq. Thousands of children have been dying every month, year in and year out, for 10 years. And my question to you is, would you agree with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright when she said the dying of those thousands of children month in and month out due to the sanctions is a price worth paying? Or would you support the lifting of sanctions on all domestic products needed to provide the food, the medicine, the products they need to clean up the polluted water system that was destroyed during the Gulf War?
All right, let's just move down the line here and get comments. Michael Cerisi?
Well, we've been asked this question, I think, now on a couple of occasions, and what I have said is that, look, we are the most powerful nation in the world by far, and we ought to be able to take the first step. And what I would say, and it's just a different paradigm out there today, and we should take the first step in giving a period of time where we want verifiable information with regard to biological and nuclear weapons, but ease the sanctions for a period of time, take the first step, and see if they respond. That, to me, is what the most powerful nation in the world can do. If they respond, then we are moving down the road of negotiation.
Mark Dayton?
I would profoundly disagree with Secretary of State Albright. I think that's a horrific statement to make. I would support lifting the embargo of food, medicine, and consumer products from Iraq. I think we should do the same with Cuba. We ought to be in the spirit of true leadership in the world, we ought to be making those resources available and encouraging the uplifting of standards of living, which is the best way to preserve world peace and expand democracy. And we also ought to stop becoming one of the only two nations that's not signed the United States Convention on the Rights of Children and remains...
Okay.
And there remains a barrier to the landmine removal from this planet, so we stop maiming children and other civilians.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Janicich?
I actually was on the bridge a couple weeks ago with the people supporting lifting the sanctions. Food and medicine from the greatest country in the world should never, ever use food and medicine as a weapon. Just think about how we would feel if we saw our children starving in front of us. That hate would go on for a very long time, I think.
Rebecca Yanish?
Yes. Growing up on the farm, my father often talked with great pride about feeding the world. And he took great pride in that role of growing the grain and the crops to feed the world. And it wasn't a discussion of feeding only the friends of the United States, but feeding the world. And I think that's a policy we should stand by, not only with our food, but our medicine.
Yes and no answer before we wrap up this hour. Critics say that the Democrats have become too centrist. They've lost their progressive principles. Senator Wellstone says after the election, get a third progressive force together in this country? Do you agree with the senator? Rebecca Yannis, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Jerry Janicich, Mark Dayton?
I don't understand the question. A third party?
No, no, a third force.
We're either liberal or not. If Senator Wellstone has proposed it, I'll a leap of faith, I'll say yes.
Mike Cerisi? Yes or no?
No,
we're out of time.
No. Well, I'm not ready to say that.
Okay, we got to go.
No, I do not want to form a third party or a progressive.
Well, yes or no?
You're listening to a debate featuring the four major candidates for the DFL U.S. Senate nomination. We're broadcasting live this evening from the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. Our debate co-sponsored by Minnesota Public Radio and the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Short break for news headlines. When we come back, more questions from the audience, so stay tuned. Primary election is Tuesday. Time to decide if you're planning to vote in the DFL primary. This is the last debate before the primary, and we will be back in just a couple of minutes.